Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Club Studio in Templeton, USA, it's Necro Nullipod with your host, Mark Stoffel, Mike Marcana, episode 106, Richard Matheson's Shadow on the Sun, the story of an ancient roadkill, and the people have to clean it up. And now, Necro Nullipod!
Those found without specific military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Comrade Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
We're kind of on fire, aren't we?
What do you mean?
Well, we're just knocking these, we're setting these books up and knocking them down.
Really? It's like playing t-ball.
No, between the last Richard Matheson book and this one, I have read three others.
Well, the beauty of Richard Matheson is his books are short and sweet.
Short and sweet,
just
yeah.
How I like it.
Yeah, no, I read a couple of his other novels, and then I just finished this one a couple days ago. Shadow on the Sun.
What do we think Islands about in that? The Stream.
What do we think about that? Islands in the Stream.
That's what I kept singing in my head as I was listening to
Shadows on the Sun. Oh, God. Now they're singing. And several listeners just turned us off.
I realized in one of our episodes that you edited, all my singing was cut out.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, you know, I could have auto-tuned it, but I didn't really have the software.
Auto-tune, hey. I can keep a tune.
Anyway. So Shadow on the Sun.
Yeah.
It's a weird Western.
It really is.
Yeah. So I was looking up a little bit about the weird Western before you came over this evening, and I thought that it was a relatively new genre. Because, you know, it's been showing up, it's, you know, the term weird Western has been showing up in various genre.
Oh, that's an actual term.
Yeah. Hmm. It's a weird Western. But no, it's actually very old.
How old is it? Does it go back to like cannibals and
no, it's stuff like when the Western genre is, you know, it's an American genre of writing that's, you know, arose in the 19th century. But adding supernatural elements to it, I thought that was relatively new. Like, you know, something that Stephen King did with the Gunfighter books, and maybe you can argue that the Wild Wild West, the TV show, was a weird Western.
Sure.
And in fact, they both are. But it goes even further back than that. There was a comic book that in the 70s that's probably still going called Jonah Hex.
Oh yeah,
that's a weird Western.
There's a movie of it or something.
Yeah, there was
a graphic novels too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think even back in the pulp days in the 30s, there was weird Westerns, and probably I think there was weird Western serials.
Like, so it's in our, but it's in our the last two centuries. It's not like
from the
1800s or something.
Basically, as long as there have been Westerns, there have been weird Westerns.
People, like the Zane Grey, right?
No, he wrote pretty straight up Westerns. But you know, the genre of the weird is as old as the genre of the Western, and it wasn't a new idea to combine the two.
Okay.
Yeah, because going into reading this book, I thought, well, this is, you know, Richard Matheson is sort of kicking off the weird Western here, and it had been around for a long time. So
he doesn't get kudos for that.
No kudos.
Screw
for
you,
that.
Richard Matheson.
Of course, he himself hadn't written very many of them. Although you were just pointing out in the front matter of the copy of the book that you have that he does have other Westerns, which was news to me.
Oh.
I don't know if they're weird or not. It's weird that there are.
That there would be. I think that they would be weird, wouldn't you?
Well, he wrote realistic things too. In fact, his first novel, which wasn't published until much later after he became famous, was just in a sort of a fictionalized account of his time in the Army or Navy in World War II. It's just a war novel, straight up war novel.
Hmm.
So
what do you think of this one?
You know, I liked it pretty well. It was.
You sound tenuous.
You know, it's the third one by an author, and frankly, for me, it was the seventh by this author.
All right.
And well, just saying that, I liked it pretty well. After seven books by the same author, that's actually very high praise. I pretty much read almost everything I have by him.
Oh.
We can talk a little bit later about some of the other books that we haven't read. I just want to mention one that was, I think, his masterpiece. But we'll save that for after we have our cocktail.
Okay. Explained. I have to be a little drunk before I hear that.
You definitely do. But I thought this was a really solid piece of adventure. I was puzzled for a long time what exactly the nature of the monster was, although there was clearly a monster. And it was interesting to have it revealed. But it didn't make me feel... I wasn't really surprised. I wasn't particularly scared. It was a little too straightforward of a novel for me to get super excited about.
Yeah, it was like he set it up and
knocked it down.
Knocked it down.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's pretty much how
it was one frame of bowling.
I mean, there was a lot... To me, it seemed like there was a lot going on because you have the... you have the Native American, you know, you have that conflict.
Yeah.
And then you have, like, the government.
Yep.
And then you have this weird mythology that just gets, like...
It was actually...
Like, just crammed in there. And then this weird ritual that, as I was reading it, I was going, now... Did he actually witness this? Or should I feel uncomfortable reading this Injun lore?
Yeah, well...
You know, that kind of thing. And then it ended. And here's the one thing I've noticed about him, the three books. And I said it last time.
You said it last time.
He just ends them.
Yeah.
There is no denouement. There is...
nothing.
There is nothing. It is...
And we're done. Yeah, no, because
okay, goodbye.
It reaches the climax at the very end when they finally are able to resolve the situation and dispatch the creature to their satisfaction, because there's not anything after that. You don't know. It's like, well, did it work? No, they just start sawing off the head. We'll see.
Yeah, in a way, his endings are not satisfying to me. Because you want to know a little bit, like, are they going to be happy? Are they going to be...
Yeah.
No, it's all up to you. It's all a mystery.
Is the rich guy going to go back east and with a new appreciation of a white man, Indian affairs?
Is he going to... Right,
or is he just going to descend back
into... Is this thing going to rise up again? You know, what... Right,
you don't know.
It's done.
Yeah, and honestly, so coming into this, I really don't have much to say about it. I was thinking when we picked the book, I was like, well, we could talk about the weird Western. Not really. But what I do want to talk about is the handling of Native American issues.
Okay.
Which is, because of my line of work, I deal with a lot of academic writing having to do with Native American issues, contemporary issues and culture and things like that. I am hypersensitive to how you deal with this. And this is Richard Matheson writing. This is published in 1994, so he's probably at the time in his 70s, late 60s, 70s when he was writing this. A different era. He grew up with John Wayne and all that stuff that is so easy to disparage now.
But he also was around during the Native American...
Yes, he was around during that, too. ...conflict
during the 70s and...
Yep, yep. And I have to say, all in all, because he also has to try to be... You know, he's writing, for the most part, from a white man's point of view. He also has to be, have some sort of verisimilitude, because white men's attitudes in the late 19th century were pretty... undeveloped.
Well, the main character, who is the our protagonist,
the Indian agent.
He, he's the one who is really, who we're supposed to be paying attention to, and he's clearly it's not about noble savages. Nope. It's not about these are people. Yeah, and
his big revelation, which is news to every other character, is that Indians are a people. And that's, to you and me, that's like, that's okay. Anything else? that's pretty much it. But I, that's really a lot to expect, even from just from the history, the really horrible history that he's dipping into here.
Well, yeah, within the context of who the character is, who he's talking to,
yeah,
and dealing with,
yeah,
you know, I think it's, you know, is it a big revelation to the person reading it? No,
no.
But is it in the book? Is it? Yes,
yes. I have to say, I was very pleased that one of the characters, the guy from out east, whose name is escaping me, even though I finished this the other day, that they've sort of become, you know, begrudging buddies, cop buddies. He learns a, Boutel is his name. He learns that the, what he thought are, were, you know, godless savages, you know, were people. Beyond that, I don't know that this book has anything to say, or really is trying to say anything about Anglo Native American relations. But I do appreciate that he seems to have done a good bit of research, and he tries to be respectful as an author.
Right. What we just don't know is, are some of the things he portrayed, you know, because there is the, you know, the hand over the mouth, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that, all that. That's not happening in this, but you wonder, you know, there is that sort of fake Indian lore bullshit that you see in movies, and you wonder, you know, the secret rituals and all that. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, Marty, but we tend to do that with every culture, Celtic cultures and voodoo cultures.
Well, exactly. And especially when you're writing a book that has to do with supernatural forces, it's just going to find its way in there. I mean, we're not right to expect this to be a, we're not expecting this to be Black Elk Speaks or anything like that. Anyway, he's writing a Western. So he's also, you know, he's trying to be respectful to several things, you know, the history of the West, the reality of Native American culture, but also the history of and the conventions of the Western genre, which at times can be pretty racist.
Yes, the thing that you see in the book is probably the underlying thing is that people, two of the characters who are sort of polar sides of each other, opposites of each other, change. Yes. So the chief's son, he has to, something kind of cracks and he sort of flexes a little bit more about this, it's Finley, right?
Yeah, Finley.
About this white guy, and the guy from out east has to
adapt,
flex a little bit about what he's holding on to. And so that's that, I think, in the book, if there's anything, if there's like a theme, it's that's the theme. It's like the openness to see what other people have to offer you.
Yeah, exactly.
And that might be reading more into it even more than it needs to, but I think it is, that is there.
Sure.
And it kind of is what saves the day, really. And,
I was also going to say that, that, you know, we're actually, as readers, when we, cringe at this a little bit, at the, you know, the attitudes that, the Anglos have against the Indians and vice versa, we don't have, as actual historical personages would, the actual direct experience of the war that just ended.
No.
And that's once, if you see atrocities, you see people, you know, people get killed by the other side, and you're just not going to be rational about it.
No.
And that's still true today. So I should, you know, I mean, I am actively trying to cut, you know, the book as much slack as I can. I just wanted to sort of like acknowledge the uncomfortableness that I feel when I'm reading books set in this genre, the Western genre. Mm-hmm. From my point of view, from mm-hmm. where I sit. Mm-hmm. So, there.
Yes.
That's all I have to say about that.
Got very serious here in the Bedenbrook Group studio. But let's just say those are all like contrivances to tell a story.
Yes.
So what about? So the creature is this, like the spawn of a,
like an eagle god or a hawk,
yeah,
eagle god.
Like an old god.
Yeah.
Right. Who mated with a woman mm-hmm. and created this.
This
creature
that can change between
sort of a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
And he's in the mythology, he's killed
and beheaded.
Cut up and beheaded, and mm-hmm. his body parts are cut up, aren't they?
Yeah, he's
kind of scattered.
He's scattered, yeah.
And this white dude comes in, this archaeologist or yes. anthropologist, and wants to see magic.
Uh-huh.
And so this badass shaman obliges
the night doctor
for money, which is
an awesome name.
But that's the other thing. I think that was the other little thing in this about, you know, looking at cultures to be entertained mm-hmm. by another culture and sort of treating them as set pieces too. Like, well, I want to see some Indian magic.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's really what this guy did, and he got his comeuppance for...
Yes, he did.
Because, like, this is taking something sacred and,
yeah.
you know, show me your
yeah.
gods, you know, like,
there's as a, if it didn't... There's a pretty famous Native American scholar and writer named Vine Deloria Jr., who has, I think actually it's the title of his essay. If not, it's a really regularly quoted thing about Native tribes' relationships with white scholars. They just sort of, they can see them pulling up in the truck and getting out of their cars, and they just say to each other, here come the anthros.
They really do that?
Well, it was a common sight. It's like, oh, you know, these civilizations are vanishing, so we need to study them, put a pin in them, because they're vanishing. And then Vine Deloria said, we're not vanishing, we're surviving. And we're enduring.
Right. And we're not going to stay the same just for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
We're gonna preserve ourselves and keep ourselves the way we choose.
So that, you know, that was sort of, I think that was sort of the straw man in this story. Is that,
yeah. He was kind of a clown.
He was an easy fodder to yeah. be and he picked gets, off eventually.
Yeah, he gets pulled apart by an eagle.
It's that hubris, you know, and that sort of... you know, that lackadaisical attitude that he was messing with stuff he shouldn't have been messing with for his own enjoyment.
So whether it would have helped resolve the plot sooner or not, he refuses to tell anybody what he saw or what he did.
Right.
Why? And I was wondering why, because I thought, you know,
I thought it was because he was ashamed.
Yeah, or he was ashamed, or he had somebody had put a spell on him or something like that. I think it was just simply because, in his scientistic way of looking at things, he literally could not bring it into his conscious mind and speak it out loud. That even though he was there to find magic and he saw it and they refused to acknowledge it, believe it.
What a dumbass.
What a dumbass. there's that character again, in Matheson's books. The scientist who refuses to see the phenomena that doesn't quite jive with
That's right.
There he is again. So
who was he in Stir of Echoes? Is that the psychologist?
It's the psychologist who says that ghost is not real.
Right. And he doesn't get any comeuppance, though.
No. And then Hell House, it's...
And he does get his comeuppance.
He definitely does.
And in this one, he gets his comeuppance. Yep. Right.
Yeah, so that was that's definitely something out of Mr. Matheson's bag of tricks that he pulled up for this one again.
All right, so there's those... we mentioned two bag of tricks, right, that he... this one, mm-hmm. that he ends abruptly without without much falderal. What else? And you've read Seven. So what else do you see are his
of tricks? He is excellent. I mean, he's excellent at describing action. And everything I've read by him, the actual physical moving of bodies through space, ducking behind things, moving things, opening doors, throwing things. Because I think that's a pretty hard thing to do without actually getting into, like,
because you can get lost. Yeah, some authors get lost in trying to describe what's happening.
And he drew his arm back 3/4 away and you know, put 60 pounds of force behind the baseball and it flew 38 feet. Well, they usually don't do that to that detail. But that's the kind of weeds that's pretty easy to get lost in.
Right.
And Richard Matheson doesn't do that. He is, in a few strokes, he's able to just bring you along. And some of these action scenes can be quite extended.
And he's very visual. I mean, he's a visual author, I think.
But I have to say, even though he's a script writer, he wrote many, many scripts. I didn't get that cinematic, he's actually just sort of describing a screenplay here. He's converting a screenplay that I get with some more contemporary books or contemporary authors.
Right. Like we read one a while, like last year, that seemed like, oh, he's trying to get on TV.
Yeah, he's trying to get on TV. Yeah.
But he was already on TV, so
he was. He was.
What else have you noticed as a pattern?
Gosh. I don't know. The clash of worldviews comes up a lot.
That comes up, yeah.
It comes up a lot. And that sort of goes into the scientist only believing so much. But in a larger way, the clash of worldviews is across all three of these books.
What do you think what would you say is his view about evil?
Oh.
Because there's evil in the three stories we read, there's evil.
Yes.
I'm going to tell you what I think it is.
I haven't given it a thought, so I'm going to give you the microphone.
Well, I think it goes back to that, something you said a couple years ago, is that really the evil's in man.
Yeah. I can do bad all by myself. I don't need Satan to do
it. I mean, it's all magnified supernaturally, but it's evil is in man. And even this, the monster in this book,
mm-hmm.
he was already defeated.
Mm-hmm.
It was the evil, the greed, the hubris of these two men.
Mm-hmm.
The night doctor and the anthropologist, archaeologist, that bring it back.
Yes.
And wreak all this havoc. And it's really men. So that's right. And I think in Stir of Echoes, it's, you know, the supernatural thing just points to the evil
of men.
That man. And in Hell House, the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just supernatural just magnifies the evil.
Yeah, it does.
So it's not coming from anywhere else other than us.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's right. I think that's my takeaway with him.
Sure, sure.
What do you?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't really have anything to add to that. I mean, I think that's right. That's exactly right. I'm just trying to think of these other themes that I've picked up having read several other books now, too. Your point about evil carries through almost 100%, except for the one book, which I think is his, as far as I can tell, his masterpiece, which we haven't read.
Which is?
The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Well, you think it's his masterpiece?
It is
Over I, Legend?
It is so good. It is so good. I Am Legend is foundational, and it's that's a great, great book. But maybe I was just so surprised that Shrinking Man was such a profound book.
Well, is there evil in the Incredible Shrinking Man?
No.
No. No. Something, it's a different story.
It's a different story.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's so, it fits in really interestingly with Stir of Echoes, because it's about suburban life in the 50s and the changing roles of men. One could say
the shrinking that they were, that they men. Were shrinking.
He makes such perfect thematic use of the shrinking of the man. Literally, he's, you know, getting smaller, but at first his you know, his ability to do his job well is starts to suffer, and then his wife starts subconsciously starting to infantilize him, and then he can't support her. And then worse, his daughter is bigger than him. And then finally, the cat. And then insects. And he's just... It has a lot to say. It resonates really interestingly with the mid-century American culture.
Even now.
It was great.
Does he just become a molecule then in the end? Or?
Yeah, in the end, he sort of breaks through to another reality.
Oh.
But that's how it ends. Very suddenly, exactly like...
Oh, I'm in another reality.
I'm in another reality.
The end.
I thought I was going to die. People give a... I'm going to go on too much about Incredible Shrinking Man here, if I'm not careful. But he shrinks by 1/7 of an inch every day. And people who know about arithmetic versus geometric progression, uh-huh. It's like you would shrink by a percentage every day, not by a fixed distance. So he thinks that when he reaches, you know, the book flashes back and forth, and he's, you know, he starts at the beginning of the book, he's an inch tall, and so it's the next 7 days. So he thinks that, you know, I'm 1/7 of an inch tall now, tomorrow I'll be 0/7, therefore I will disappear. But no, he doesn't. He just drops through to a new reality, which we find nothing about.
Oh, seriously? You don't even know, like, nothing. Are we an inch world or something? Or?
Yeah, nothing. He doesn't, yeah. He doesn't describe anything of it.
Why does he do that? What's your theory about why does he just end like that?
I don't know, but I kind of respect it. Even though, I have to say, it's a little infuriating once in a while. Like, I wanted some more denouement in Shadow on the Sun.
I know, at least, like
another 2 pages.
Right.
I'm not asking for a lot.
Right. Right.
But no, you don't get. I think he thinks it's economical. And he's like, you know, this is it. This is
I the told the story.
My story is done.
Yeah. And they lived happily. Yeah. They didn't even live happily. They just lived.
Yeah. Not one word more.
Right.
This is it. So I kind of grudgingly respect that.
I liked the book okay. I thought that it took me a while to start to get who all the players were and who I'm really was going to need to pay attention to. And it seemed all kind of jumbled. And then once it started chugging along and it kind of narrowed down to who's up against who, then it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then I got into it. And
yeah. It was a bit of a jumble at the beginning because I was sure like the Easterner was going to be, you know, once characters are being introduced and then being devoured, I was sure that guy was going to get cruel comeuppance, but he doesn't. He actually, you know, he learns.
Right.
And is redeemed.
Which is the lesson. I think that's another lesson. If you learn,
won't get eaten.
Right. Exactly. Well, what say you? Is it?
I believe it is.
The time of the cocktail?
It is the time of the cocktail.
Oh.
Do you know what you mean?
Well, so tell the folks what we're drinking here.
Well, it's a little something we call a tequila sundown. So what do? You get yourself a Collins glass and throw in a bunch of rocks, ice, and then...
Thank you.
Well, for the
novices. I was going to go out and dig up some gravel.
Just for the novices. And then you put in, what do we say, a shot of tequila, and 2 ounces each of orange juice and some sort of sparkling soda. If you like it sweeter, you can put in 7-Up or something like that. Just do
club
soda. But I would recommend club
soda. That's what we're drinking, or seltzer.
Yep. So that should almost fill the glass. See, leave a little bit of room on the top. Give that a stir. And then to top it, you put in a half shot each of Campari and Chambord. And sort of let that filter down.
Filter down.
See what we did there? It's a tequila sundown. And it's good.
I'm not going to sing it. I'm not going to sing it. But it's good.
But it's good. So there you go.
It's a good one for brunch.
Yeah. Or really anytime.
Anytime.
All right. It's your turn.
All right. It's down to the basement we go.
Down to the basement. So.
Wait, are we down there yet?
Yes.
Now we are.
So here's my pitch. Instead of doing a single author for the next three podcasts,
okay,
I think we should do three novels that take Lovecraft's tradition and do something weird with it.
Okay, say more about that. I'm not totally sold on this yet.
So, okay. Because
it goes totally against what we were going to do. But
well,
okay.
No, we were going to do themes. So I have three specific novels in mind, by the way. But, so, you know, Lovecraft has this long tradition of Lovecraftian...
As a Lovecraftian.
But a lot of his followers would write sort of in his same mode, or change things a little bit.
We've read some of them.
Yeah, we have.
Liber.
Fritz Liber did that. Yeah, he was actually a correspondent with Lovecraft. He wrote probably one of the earliest, at best, and most influential essays about Lovecraft. After Lovecraft died, the Lovecraft industry just keeps growing. You see it in movies; it's all over the place in graphic novels, and in novels. Some of our other books that we've read, the Croning,
yeah,
by Laird Barron.
The Croisening.
That was Lovecraftian. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones.
Don't try.
I won't.
Don't.
Because now that I think about it, we really haven't. I mean, I've read some of these books myself, but I don't think we've actually.
Oh, the one with the worm, Brian Keene.
That
had a Lovecraftian.
That's giving it too
Lovecraftian.
That's giving it too much credit.
I know, but he was trying.
Yes, I'll get it.
The one with the house with the the hotel, the apartment building, and
That was Lovecraftian.
That's Lovecraftian. Yeah.
That was 14 by Peter Klein.
Yes.
That has a sequel, which I've read.
14 and a half.
No, it's called The Fold.
Okay. So
I'm suggesting that for the next three books, we read three, I'm hoping, pretty different kinds of books that are all picking up Lovecraft's mythology.
Okay, what are they?
The first one is by Roger Zelazny. I think called a Night in October, A Night in Red October.
He wrote something about In Amber, right?
Yeah, he wrote the Amber novels.
Yeah, okay.
And this is his last novel before he passed away suddenly in the 90s. The second one I'm proposing is a mashup of Jack Kerouac and Lovecraft. I can't think of what the title is, but I'll get it to you.
Okay.
And the third one is the first of a series of secret agent novels that this secret agency is battling Lovecraftian forces. It's called The Laundry Files by British author Charles Stross.
That all sounds awesome. I do think it's far afield from what we've talked about, but I will go with it.
I appreciate your roll with itness.
Well, as we've learned, if you do not flex, you will be eaten.
You will be eaten. So true.
All right.
So next week we're going to read...
It's called A Night in Lonesome October.
Yes. And then after that, we're going to read a book by Nick Mamatas called Move Underground. And that one's actually available for free online, although he does publish it as well. But it's gotten good reviews. And
what is it? Mamatas?
Mamatas. M-A-M-A-T-A-S.
Mamatas.
You'll be editing that one, so you just say whatever you want. You should definitely sing in that episode.
All right.
Okay.
And the last one is what?
It's called the It's The Laundry Files, Volume 1. I think it's called the... I can't remember. It's okay. By Charles Strauss.
We'll talk. Well, don't read ahead.
Don't read ahead. Well, read ahead, but not too far ahead.
Okay. All right, let's get out of the basement. Out of the basement. So, what... is that it? Anything else? That's, Richard Matheson?
I have to say, Richard Matheson was really fun to read. I have two more books of the my shelf full of Richard Matheson. I have two more left to read. They're both later novels. One was made into a movie called What Dreams May Come.
Mm-hmm. That movie.
Yeah. And that was I think I'm pretty sure he gets deep into his philosophy of psychic powers and afterlife and you know, the soul. And then there's another one, which was one of his last novels, called Other Kingdoms, which has something to do with fairies.
Hmm.
So he'll use his theorizing to help us understand the psychic power of fairies or something like that. I may or may not read those soon. Probably not. I'd like to have a few out there unread. So. Well, yeah.
Well, I think I want to read The Incredible Shrinking Man. I'll let you talk about it. Or at least see the movie.
Just loved it. Yeah, he wrote the script for the movie, too, although it's very different. I think it's different. The novel is, you know, there's one bit in the novel where he is, it's creepy because he can't make love to his wife anymore because it's humiliating because she will do it. She will take care of him, so to speak. But the condescension and I'm doing my wifely duty is more than he can bear. And as as his balls, if I may put it so crudely, get bluer and bluer, he starts to ogle the babysitter, the daughter's babysitter, who is, you know, this chunky, pimply, you know, 16-year-old. And he's just, you know, waiting to see her naked. And it's really disturbing from the point of view of a reader in 2015. But I think, you know, Matheson is trying to get at something about, you know, his dwindling, you know, masculine potency by writing that. And it's a really creepy part of the book.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, plus he does
battle. I don't think that was in the movie.
No. Yeah, plus he does battle with a Black Widow spider.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. In fact, it's one of the first scenes of the book.
Is he, does his... sexual powers diminish?
Let me just say that the pot keeps getting bigger, but the spoon stays the same size.
That's probably... Oh, yeah, okay. That's hilarious. Why doesn't he just crawl up in there?
Good Lord. You know, if he was writing... If Richard Matheson was a young novice writing today, that scene, I'm sure, would be there.
Oh, God. Sweet Jesus. That was before vibrators, I think.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
All right, well...
On that note...
On that happy note... I think what we should do is get an airplane ticket to Arizona.
Yep. Circle around until we see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
send it to the Grand Canyon. On a donkey.
Yeah, we'll send it down to the Grand Canyon with a donkey and let the donkey come up alone.
Yeah. Okay, All right.
Bye.
Bye. You may have to drag me away from my demons, kicking and screaming. It's been so long, I've been with them. Don't know where they stop and I begin. Yeah.
to drag me away.